Hello everyone, and welcome to Genocide News Now, a bi-weekly news update from the Anti-Genocide Coffee Break, a multinational podcast. We are your hosts, Molly Reagan and Teresa Merck, and you can find us at www.lemkininstitute.com, as well as on Patreon, Spotify, and iTunes. All the news and action items mentioned in this podcast are available on our website. Now let's dive into the news. We start this episode in India, where protests have erupted after the government of Prime Minister Narendra Modi announced it will implement the 2019 Citizenship Amendment Act. The CAA fast-tracks citizenship for the, quote, persecuted religious minorities of Hindus, Parsis, Sikhs, Buddhists, Jains, and Christians who have fled to Hindu-majority India from mainly Muslim Afghanistan, Bangladesh, and Pakistan before December 31, 2014. In the latest rounds of protests against the measures that is seen by many as a political ploy by Modi and his ruling Hindu Nationalist Party, the BJP, in the run-up to India's election, hundreds have been injured and dozens killed, mostly being Muslim citizens of India. The CAA is firmly in line with the BJP's rhetoric, which has consistently sought to cast Muslim immigrants and refugees as, quote, infiltrators and, quote, illegal, whereas those from other groups are called, quote, asylum seekers. In a recent publication, Human Rights Watch cites a 2018 election speech by Home Secretary Amit Shah, in which he said, quote, illegal immigrants are like termites, and they are eating the food that should go to our poor, and they are taking our jobs. They carry out blasts in our country, and so many of our people die, end quote. He was referring to Muslim immigrants from Bangladesh in this speech. He promised that, quote, if we come to power in 2019, we will find each and every one and send them away. Action against them should not worry any patriot, end quote. The implementation of the CAA has also sparked anxiety among the nation's 200 million Muslims, particularly when coupled with the planned creation of the citizen verification process known as the National Register of Citizenship. The government-compiled NRC would list all official Indian citizens, leaving many Muslims throughout the country fearful that they would be unable to produce the proper documentation to be included on the register. Those living in India who are not found on the register would be subject to the newly formed foreigner tribunals that are empowered to deprive individuals of their citizenship and send them to a detention center. According to Amnesty International, in such a scenario, only the religious groups mentioned in the CAA would be able to retain their citizenship through the discriminatory application of the Citizenship Amendment Act, while others, including Muslims, would be rendered stateless. Such discriminatory laws targeting citizenship are frequent precursors to genocide.
April 7th marked 30 years since the 1994 genocide of the Tutsi of Rwanda. Rwandans commemorated this anniversary with a week of national mourning for the approximately 800,000 Tutsis lost over the course of 100 days in 1994. All these years later, graves are continuing to be uncovered across the country, and only 28 genocide suspects have been extradited to Rwanda from around the world, while hundreds remain at large, with many residing in neighboring countries such as the Democratic Republic of the Congo and Uganda. At the time of the genocide, Hutus made up approximately 85% of the Rwandan population, with the rest consisting of the Tutsi minority and a small percentage of Twa, the original inhabitants of the country. Politicized ethnic identity is central to the story of the Rwandan genocide. While the groups labeled Hutu and Tutsi shared the same culture, language, and religion and could not be identified by phenotypic differences, the importance of the distinction between Hutu and Tutsi was written deeply into Rwanda's history. In pre-colonial times, Tutsis were associated with the ruling kingdom and the Hutus were the governed or commoners. All were part of the same social system and were in no way different tribes. It was only under German and Belgian colonization that these two identities became ossified and racialized as two distinct peoples. So colonization introduced the genocidal categories that furthered the 1994 genocide. During Rwanda's independence struggle, Hutus had already forced as many as 330,000 Tutsi out of the country in an independence revolution that began in 1959. Conflict between the two groups continued following Rwanda's independence in 1962, and Hutu moderate Major General Juvenal Habyarimana was installed to power in 1973. Habyarimana was eventually elected as president under the new constitution and remained in power for two decades. When forces from the Rwandan Patriotic Front, primarily Tutsi refugees, invaded Rwanda in 1990 from Uganda, Habyarimana accused Tutsi residents of being accomplices and hundreds were arrested. Many others would be killed before the official start of the genocide in 1994. Following a plane crash carrying Rwandan President Habyarimana on April 6, 1994, the Hutu extremists laid the blame for the incident on the Rwandan Patriotic Front, or RPF, the Tutsi-led army. The crash was used as an excuse by Hutu extremists to exterminate all Tutsis via the successful use of government propaganda and a reliance on historic ethnic tensions. The Hutu power extremists were ultimately successful in persuading and coercing the Hutu population to help carry out the killing. The killing of Tutsis was coordinated by the Interahamwe, a name that translates to those who attack together. These were specially trained militias that were created from government forces and Hutu militia groups. They began killing Tutsis in Kigali a few hours after President Habyarimana's plane was shot from the sky. They also targeted moderate Hutus and began distributing weapons to ordinary Hutus. The international community failed Rwanda. The UN had stationed peacekeepers in Rwanda already in 1993. Despite the heroic efforts of their leader, General Roméo Dallaire, the UN failed to heed several warnings of the genocide in the early months of 1994. When genocide broke out, the UN and all Western nations pulled out of the country, leaving the Tutsi to be slaughtered. Only Dallaire and a few heroic peacekeepers stayed in, against orders, saving thousands of lives. The killing only ended with the military victory of the RPF, headed by current President Paul Kagame. The legacy of this genocide on the country and the region more generally cannot be understated. Following the genocide, policies were put in place which de-emphasized ethnic identity in an attempt to promote social cohesion. Paul Kagame became president in 2000 and has been re-elected on three separate occasions, although the elections are not considered free and fair, so it is difficult to assess to what extent this is a referendum on Kagame and his policies. Rwanda has pursued an independent path under Kagame, who has sought to distance the country from dependence on the Western powers who betrayed the country in 1994. Rwanda has flourished economically and has instituted a peace-building curriculum in all schools, as well as peace and reconciliation efforts arising in the country, where perpetrators and survivors must live side by side. One of the more controversial aspects of Kagame's rule is his involvement in the conflict in the neighboring country of the Democratic Republic of Congo, wherein many Hutu extremists regrouped following the genocide. The Democratic Forces for the Liberation of Rwanda, a Hutu extremist group which took part in the 94 genocide, takes refuge in the DRC, and UN experts have said there is a link between President Kagame and a Tutsi rebel group operating in the country, a group that called itself the March 23 Movement, or M23. It has been suggested by some that Kagame's investment in M23 reflects his larger ambition to assert regional dominance and secure access to mineral rights. The ongoing tensions between Tutsi and Hutu militias, which are playing out regionally, demonstrate that the attempts at suppressing ethnic identity following the genocide were not entirely successful, and that a power struggle remains between the two ethnic groups to this day. This genocide resulted in the loss of 800,000 Tutsi lives, 800,000 innocent men, women, and children whose only offense was their ethnic identity. Lemkin Institute honors these victims and those they left behind. It is both necessary and painful to look back and see the failed policies and actions which allowed for this tragedy to play out. The international community must do a better job of reacting to and pushing against genocidal ideology and policy when it appears, so that we do not lose another 800,000 innocent lives because of the inaction of a few.
April 15th marked the one-year anniversary of the war in Sudan. What started as a power struggle between the Sudanese armed forces and their one-time allies, the Rapid Support Forces, has devolved into a massive displacement crisis that threatens the region and has rekindled the genocide in Darfur. Today, control of the country is largely split east-west between the two factions, with little hope of anything other than escalation on the horizon. Doctors Without Borders estimates that 8.4 Sudanese, including 2 million children under the age of 5, have been forced to flee their homes in the last 12 months. This displacement is compounded by the threat of widespread famine. According to the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Turk, nearly 18 million people face acute food insecurity, 14 million of them children, with over 70% of hospitals no longer functional amid a rise in infectious disease. The International Crisis Group reports that about 90% of those suffering acute food insecurity are stuck in areas of active conflict, including millions of residents in the greater Khartoum area and its sister city of Gezira. The two sides generally show callous disregard for civilians' plights, with the RSF demanding sky-high fees from aid trucks at checkpoints or stealing their cargo, while the army tries to block relief in RSF-held areas where many camps of the internally displaced and devastated towns have been unable to receive assistance. As the conflict has deepened, regional fragmentation is increasing along ethnic lines. Hate speech is on the rise, increasing the likelihood of more mass killings and sexualized violence than has already occurred over the last 12 months. Though the conflict has had such a large impact on so many lives, those affected feel largely forgotten by the world. With the international community stretched thin due to the myriad humanitarian crises across the globe, and domestic politics in many countries making governments less able to give foreign aid, only 5% of the requisite funding for Sudan had been secured by this grim first anniversary. The Lemkin Institute mourns for those Sudanese whose lives have been upended or lost by this conflict. We are committed to continuing to shine a light on their plight and impel the international community to action.
Conflict and insecurity have been active in Haiti for some time now, with the assassination of democratically elected President Jovenel Moise in 2021, leaving a power vacuum that was filled by Ariel Henry, the prime minister under Moise. This move was supported by several nations, including the United States. With elections being put on hold multiple times since Henri's assumption of power, protests have become increasingly common. When Henri announced in 2023 that elections would not take place until 2025, armed groups increased the violence in the nation's capital, Port-au-Prince. According to United Nations estimate, rebel forces have taken control of approximately 80% of the capital and are responsible for the increase in killings, kidnappings, and rapes that have occurred there since Moise's death. A report released by the United Nations in January of this year estimates that more than 8,400 people have been killed, injured, or kidnapped in 2023, an increase of 122% from 2022. Although armed groups have been calling for Henri's resignation for some time now, attacking airports, police stations, seaports, and the central bank to emphasize their message, it was the escape of roughly 4,000 prisoners from two of the country's main prisons in March that has brought the situation in Haiti to a head. In just 1 week, 15,000 people have been displaced from the capital, according to an estimate by the UN. Not only that, but of the 11 million people living in Haiti, about 1 million are on the brink of famine. A decree was published on Friday, April 13th, which announced the formation of a presidential transitional council, which will choose a new prime minister and attempt to restore order in the capital. This announcement comes approximately 1 month after Henri agreed to step down as prime minister. This council is to be made up of 9 members, none of which have been named or made public. No time frame has been announced for the installation of this body or for the selection of a new prime minister and cabinet. Concerningly, some Haitian citizens accuse this council of being something which was concocted in Washington, D.C., with one reporter reflecting, "Basically, it's not a Haitian solution in any way, it's a Washington solution." Many Haitians blame foreign intervention for many of the problems the country faces today, with Haitian scholar and advocate Jemima Pierre stating that, quote, "What intervention means for Haiti, what it has always meant, is death and destruction," end quote. Haitian people have put forth their own initiatives over the years, with church leaders, women's rights groups, lawyers, humanitarian workers, the voodoo sector, and others creating the Commission to Search for a Haitian Solution to the Crisis, which has proposed a plan outlining a 2-year interim government with oversight committees tasked with restoring order, eradicating corruption, and establishing fair elections. The Lemkin Institute stands by the people of Haiti and calls on foreign governments to prioritize the voices of Haitians in their commission to resolve the crisis. Haitians are deserving of self-determination, and it is critical that they are the ones deciding the future of their country, not foreign governments who have been shown to put their own strategic interests over those of the people of Haiti.
Looking now to Nigeria, where twice in 1 week, people were kidnapped by armed gangs. The first of these abductions occurred in early March, on Wednesday, March 6th, in a remote northeast town of Borno State, wherein individuals seized women and children from a displaced person's camp while they were searching for firewood. The following day, in a town hundreds of miles away, in the northwest state of Kaduna, more than 280 children, as well as a few teachers, were kidnapped by gunmen and taken into the nearby forest. Local reports believe the second attack was carried out by militants from the Ansaru group, which has been linked to Al-Qaeda. The victims from the displaced persons camp have since been released, as have 130 of the victims from Kaduna. There has been no further reporting on the remaining abductees. These stories speak to a larger crisis occurring in Nigeria, wherein kidnap for ransom is viewed as low-risk, high-reward business, as the perpetrators are rarely arrested once they receive the funds and release those who were abducted. Indeed, the fact that more than 4,700 people have been kidnapped in the state since last May, according to risk consultants SBM Intelligence, seems to confirm that such kidnap-for-ransom schemes are viewed as lucrative for those operating in the country. Perhaps unsurprisingly, the motivation for such actions appears to be economic, with reporting by the BBC summing up the problem with the following sentence, quote, "Nigeria's poor economy creates the conditions for kidnapping," end quote. There is a perception among Nigerians of corruption in the government, which also helps explain why gangs have previously demanded foodstuffs, motorcycles, and petrol in exchange for the release of hostages, as food prices have soared in the past 6 months, with farmers' inability to access their lands for fear of attacks or abductions only contributing to the problem further. Alex Vines, director of the Africa program at Chatham House Think Tank, attributes much of the problem to the government's inability to stop the kidnappings, saying that, quote, "armed gangs have supplanted both the government and traditional rulers as the de facto authority in large swaths of the country," end quote. Vines added that while these gangs typically extort money from people, the inability or unwillingness of farmers to access their lands results in fewer funds more generally, which may also help in explaining the spike in kidnappings. Finally, the country's poorest borders contribute to insecurity, as does the Islamist violence in the wider region, where vast forest reserves in the border regions have been turned into operational bases for criminals. Balama Berkati, a senior conflict analyst at the Tony Blair Institute for Global Change, believes that transnational cooperation with Nigeria's neighbors, especially Niger, Cameroon, and Chad, is needed for such incidents to stop occurring. Additionally, Berkati adds, the authorities must be willing to bring the perpetrators to justice. When lawlessness is met with impunity, it is only natural that such activities will grow. It is therefore critical that the government demonstrates its concern over this activity with concrete actions and penalties in place for the perpetrators. That's all we have time for on this episode of Genocide News Now, but be sure to tune into future episodes and stay up to date on global news. To follow our work on conflicts with more rapid developments, such as Israel's war on the Palestinians and Azerbaijan's aggression toward Armenia, follow us on social media. You can find us at Lemkin Institute, all one word, on Instagram, the platform formerly known as Twitter, Facebook, WhatsApp, and Telegram. For more on our work in the field of genocide prevention, don't miss our website, www.lemkininstitute.com. If you would like to take action and make an individual difference, be sure to visit our Take Action page there. Thank you for listening and have a great day.